You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We take flush toilets for granted in this country, but in some parts of the world, many people live without them, and the consequences are not just disgusting at times, but potentially deadly. In her latest book, The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, Rose George argues that while many people think a toilet is their right, it actually is a privilege. Metropolitan Books is her publisher, and I'm pleased that it has brought Rose George to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
You start off the book with an experience you had at a restaurant on the Ivory Coast, the Côte d'Ivoire. What happened?
Well, like many people in every day, I needed the bathroom. And I asked the waiter the way to the bathroom, and he said, sure, follow me. He was a young Liberian refugee because the Ivory Coast is next door to Liberia, so he was obviously just working there. He led me to a room and left me there, and there was nothing in this room, nothing. There was no hole, no nothing.
No bucket. What do you think they expected you to do?
I think they expected me to make use of the facilities, which was a tiled floor.
And then somebody else would come by and clean it up?
I guess so. I mean, I went after him and asked him, and he just laughed at me and said, this isn't America, you know, you do what you can. And I think I actually chose not to use the facilities and just suffered.
What percentage of the people around the world do you think live without any access to a latrine, a toilet, or a bucket, or a hole?
Well, the official figure, the UN official figure, is 2.6 billion people. That's billion with a B. So that's 4 in 10 people who have absolutely nothing, not even the basic form of containment. So no bucket or box or anything.
Does that mean that many governments don't even bother thinking about sanitation as a matter of public policy?
It's an extremely neglected matter of public policy, and that goes across the board, even in the developed world. But a lot of countries, their water and sanitation budget is about 0.1% of their major budget, and of that, 90% goes on water and even less goes on sanitation. So it's the orphan child of development.
It's keeping the water supply clean, which is really important.
It's really important. There's no denying that, but there's no point having a clean water supply and then having such a bad sanitation situation that you are then contaminating that nice clean water. They're absolutely linked. There's no way getting around that.
Why do you think it's important to talk about human waste now, or has it always been important and you're just writing about it now?
It's always been important. I mean, these statistics, the 2.6 billion toiletless, that's been the case for decades, but we just haven't been able to talk about it. It's a good time to talk about it now because it's the International Year of Sanitation, for a start. It's also the International Year of the Potato. But it's just...
That's just coincidental.
Coincidental. The New Zealanders apparently wanted to celebrate the potato, quite reasonably.
I would have thought the Peruvians would have wanted
possibly,
to. After all, it comes from the Andes.
That's true. But luckily, someone also wanted to celebrate the toilet and sanitation. So this is a good year to talk about it.
But is it difficult to get people to listen? Because this is something of a taboo subject, isn't it?
It is a conversational taboo, particularly in the Western world and also in much of Asia as well. But the trick, as I have learned from some of the fantastic sanitation activists I've met doing this book, is to sort of lull people into it by talking about it using entertainment or comedy even, or for example, one of my heroes is a guy called Dr. Patak, who's an Indian Brahmin who has spent his life trying to liberate untouchables, whose job is to clean latrines with their bare hands. And he has set up the world's only international museum of toilets because he said, you know, the only way I'm going to get people to listen to me is to make toilets interesting. And he's doing a great job. It's now in the Lonely Planet guidebook.
How did people react when you told them that this was the subject of your new book?
Well, obviously, I've had that conversation many times over the past few years. And very surprisingly to me, I expected people to be put off by this topic. But in fact, only 2 or 3 people have changed the subject. And in fact, everybody immediately sort of pauses for a bit of bemusement and then comes out with some kind of toilet anecdote, or where they've been on vacation, they had experienced some kind of toilet. Or it's really a well of information out there that people have just got no outlet for. And
information? Are you making puns here as well?
I'm trying not to, but...
Sanitation professionals sometimes divide the world into fecal-phobic and fecal-philic cultures. What kinds of countries fit into each category?
The easy way to give you examples is to talk about India and China. China is quite at home with its excrement. It's used human waste as fertilizer for 4,000 years.
Also uses for heating, for cooking?
Right. Well, I visited a very interesting program, a biogas program in China, which is you can have a digester in your house that's connected up to your latrine and then tap off the methane and use it for cooking. So it's a very cheap fuel for millions of Chinese. There are about 15 million in China at the moment.
Is that a good thing, or
It's a very good thing, as long as the
you're cooking with waste material, aren't you?
Well, you're cooking with it's a clean gas.
Oh, you're just
gas.
Cooking with methane.
Yeah, it's just methane. It's perfectly clean, and it's also used in there's a city in northern France that has started to use biomethane as a fuel for their city buses. So it's got great potential.
I've always wondered why they don't do it in waste, those cleansing plants, why they just don't.
Some do. Some do use methane, and some do turn it into electricity and use it for power.
What about countries like your country, Britain, or the United States? Are they fecal-phobic or fecal-philiac?
I would say phobic, and I think a lot of that has to do with the linguistic problem in that we don't have a neutral word to talk about this problem or this substance, so it's been, excuse the pun, flushed out of conversation as well. So I think we have this linguistic handicap, and it's become fecal-phobic, but it wasn't always the case. That's really only been over the last 200 years.
In educating people, is there resistance to modern sanitation in some traditional societies?
Well, the new thinking in sanitation is that the sanitation ladder, this is a concept whereby at the bottom you have, say, a box or nothing, and at the top you have the flush toilet and waterborne sewage. The new thinking is that that's simply not suitable for many countries around the world. Previously, this was just handed out willy-nilly, even if there was no money to keep it going, or people didn't have the training to keep it going.
Or limited water supply.
Or limited water supply, exactly, in places like India. India has some of these sewage treatment works, but they simply don't work, and so the raw sewage is just going straight into the water. So now the thinking is that it's really time to be more flexible and to adapt a sanitation solution to the situation in hand. And there are hundreds of ways of dealing with sanitation. There's a lot of innovation in this field.
In countries like the United States, we do have sewage treatment. In the past, it just used to go right into the water, didn't it?
Right, yeah, but 150 years ago, before sewers were put in New York City, for example, yes, it was put straight into the water. But actually, even with our wonderful waterborne sewage system, which is an amazing medical advancement and has saved lots of lives, it can't cope with population growth, and it's basically crumbling, and it's still going into the water. If you have something called a sewage overflow, which happens in wet weather, then you can still get raw sewage discharged into the nearest water source quite legally.
My guest is Rose George, whose latest book is The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, published by Metropolitan Books. So why is there such a problem? What are some of the diseases that human waste carries?
There are 50 or so communicable diseases that can be carried in human waste.
I always thought hepatitis, but is that the worst, or are there
no,
others?
Well,
that
you can have cholera. Cholera is pretty dreadful; can kill you in 12 hours. And cholera was the reason we got sewers in the first place, because in London there were so many dreadful cholera epidemics. It finally got so bad that something was done about it. You can have giardia, dysentery. Obviously, there's all sorts of nasty bugs traveling in feces.
And how are they transmitted?
Generally, you can, for example, if you go to a rural area in the developing world, you'll find children playing around barefooted. If they've got no sanitation, they'll have just gone to the nearest wood or bush or whatever. They will be tramping it back into the village, and it will just be getting everywhere, contaminating everything.
So is it unlikely that we see these diseases in the United States and other countries with modern plumbing?
They do still happen. There was a very interesting survey a couple of years ago done out in Stanford, which found that there are about 1.5 million, up to 1.5 million excess gastrointestinal diseases that are linked to sewage outfalls along 28 California beaches. So it still happens. It's just that, fortunately, the death toll is certainly not what it is in the developing world. But also in 1993 in Milwaukee, there was a case where Cryptosporidium, a disease-causing amoeba, got into the water system and 100 people died. That was only in 1993.
We talked earlier about trapping methane. What about the stuff itself? Is it usable, or do we just simply try to clean it of diseases and dump it somewhere?
It is usable. Modern wastewater treatment, in the modern world, you can clean off the liquid that's clean effluent. But in the US, the product known as sludge, which has been rebaptized biosolids, is...
Biosolids sounding a lot nicer than sludge.
Sounding a lot nicer than sludge, which is why it's called biosolids, clearly. That's applied to land in great quantities. About, I think, 60 or 70% of American sludge is used as a fertilizer.
Well, if a human waste has been used as fertilizer over the years, but there was always concern that it would contaminate the produce. Is that not a problem here?
Well, it is treated. There are various classes of biosolids. There's a class A and class B, and those classes are determined on how much treatment is given to the sludge. And the EPA says that both classes are safe according to various restrictions, you know, when it can be used, what it can be used on. Having said that, there is a growing activist movement which is questioning the safety of sewage sludge. I don't know what the answer is, but there is certainly an increasing debate in the US about whether it's a good idea to use a product which is essentially the dirt that has been taken out of sewage. And that can include anything we throw down a sewer, and that's not just pure human waste. It can be anything that goes down a street or, you know, whatever you put down your sink. It can be anything.
So it could be a heavy metal, for example.
It could be. And these are regulated.
So, do we find that cadmium and mercury pop up in these biosolids?
Well, the EPA says that heavy metals are perfectly regulated, and as long as farmers who use this product follow their regulations, everything's fine. That said, there have been a couple of cases in Georgia to do with dairy herds, which where farmers used Class B biosolids, and one of those cases did find that the mortality of the cattle was greatly increased, and they did find elevated levels of cadmium in the soil and in the hay that they were eating.
Does it have an odor?
Class B solid biosolids, people who live nearby say that it does have an odor. Odor is a big headache through all the wastewater treatment system, and a lot of money is put into it trying to alleviate it.
Is this just human waste, or do we also use the waste of other animals? I know that in areas where there are pig farms, there are some serious problems, not just, and cows, of course, also. Their manure creates methane. You say methane, but it's still the same gas. Mm-hmm. But pig farms seem to be a serious polluting issue.
I have to say I have not looked into pig farms, but I do know that in the UK, cattle manure is used very widely, and you can smell it, frankly, when you drive around the UK. And I have read farmers who've put comments on websites about sewage sludge and biosolids saying, look, you're all complaining about sewage sludge, but, you know, cattle manure is less regulated, and that's being used with abandon all over the country. So it is an issue to look at animal manure as well.
My guest is Rose George, who's written for The Nation, Slate, Details, The New York Times, many other publications. And her latest book is called The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters. It is published by Metropolitan Books. We will continue our conversation. You've gone into the sewers of New York and London. I understand a lot of people want to do that. I'm not one of them, but we'll talk about that and what's being done in other parts of the world, India, China, Japan, and whatever else we can get to as we continue our conversation in the second part of it. So stay with us for more from Rose George and more about the world of human waste and why it matters. We're back with Rose George, her latest book, The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, published by Metropolitan Books. How did you wind up even thinking of this as a subject for a book?
It was really, I came to it through a character, Dr. Patak, who's in the book, who's a Brahmin, who has made it his life's work to liberate untouchables. And his story was so fascinating that I, A, thought he was so entertaining as a character, and B, that he tried to make sanitation entertaining, even though it had all these astonishing statistics that I didn't know before doing this book any more probably than anyone else.
And then you found a whole bunch of characters. You found a man named Jack Sim, and the whole Mr. Condom thing. And and there was somebody else in South Africa who was also involved in improving sanitation. So there are people around the world who have taken it upon themselves to really fight for this sort of thing.
Yeah, I call them the foot soldiers of sanitation. And luckily for me, they all come together twice a year at the conferences of the World Toilet Organization.
There really is
the other WTO. Yeah. Actually, I'm going there next week. They're having a summit in Macau. So I'm going back there. The Prince of Orange is going to be there. He's the UN Secretary General's advisor on sanitation. So it's a serious thing. But obviously, because they're happy to be known as the other WTO, they've clearly got a sense of humor as well.
And Jack Sim is an HIV campaigner.
He's not an HIV campaigner. He's the president of the WTO, the other WTO. But he learned from a HIV campaigner who's known as Mr. Condom, who's a Thai senator who's done amazing things in Thailand to bring down HIV rates, and who has set up a restaurant called Condoms and Cabbages. And so Jack learned from him that to get people to listen to you, you need to be entertaining. So Mr. Condom was Mr. Toilet's mentor.
Many public HIV awareness campaigns encounter resistance from religious conservatives or governments or people who just think that things are fine the way they are. Does the same sort of thing happen when you're talking about toilets?
Well, sanitation is so neglected it gets resistance from everyone, not even religious organizations.
Well, we see, even in the United States, resistance to building sewer systems because they're a big expense for local townships.
They are. They're very capital intensive. They're expensive. The cost isn't just financial. It's also they're pretty energy intensive. They use water, a lot of water, which is increasingly a precious resource, particularly in the water-stressed areas of the United States. So really, it's about time that people who are thinking of putting in sewer systems should really question whether that is the best solution for them.
Are septic tanks a good alternative?
They are if they're managed properly. I mean, you don't have to be on a sewer line. You can do on-site sanitation as long as the public health issue is looked after properly.
You said earlier that cholera is the reason that London built its sewer system. Was that the first sewer system in the world?
No. There were rudimentary sewer systems about 4,000 years ago.
The Romans built them as well, didn't they?
The Romans had them, but before them, on Crete, the palace of Knossos, palace of King Minos, they had rudimentary sewer systems, and they had channels which flushed away latrines. And also in the Indus Valley in modern-day Pakistan, they also had rudimentary sewer systems. So it's been around a very long time.
And then London and New York are among the older ones in the modern world. Are they still efficient?
They are increasingly fragile because of growing population. They are under pressure. They're old. They're crumbling. There isn't generally enough money to maintain them as they should be maintained. And they're suffering. That's why there are these sewage overflows every week, which discharge untreated sewage into the nearest water body. And perfectly legally, that's how the sewer system is set up, but it's not ideal.
What happens when that effluent overflows?
Well, when there is wet weather, because in the US and in the UK, what you have is a combined sewer system, so that's all the storm water and street water also goes into the same system.
And we often see problems near the waterfront.
Right. So when it rains, if you have an intense rainstorm, you have a lot of water coming down in a short space of time. The principle is that this excess volume will be kept in storm tanks, but sometimes it's just too much volume of water for the storm tanks, and it's just discharged into the nearest water body. And the idea is that it's so diluted that it won't cause any problems, but because the nutrients in human wastes, too many of those in water can suffocate water, which is why sludge is no longer dumped at sea, for example. So it can be an issue.
Did you feel it important to go into the sewer systems as part of your research?
I did. It was important, but I was also curious, and that may be just me. But I thought this whole underground city, this kind of highways underneath our feet that no one really goes down. They're dangerous for a start. You shouldn't go down them without proper guidance and my nice hosts from the Department of Environmental Protection. But there's just this whole world which keeps cities going. I mean, urban historians call the modern city the sanitary city because without sanitation, it really couldn't function.
In some old novels and some movies I've seen, people escape by going into the sewers.
Exactly. I mean, is that
could you just take off a manhole cover and
you could.
Slip
I
in?
Mean, I certainly wouldn't advise it because they are very dangerous environments. There are the gases for a start. All sorts of gases down there. You don't really want
to. Do you
come
have to
across.
Wear a gas mask?
You don't, but you do have a breathing apparatus which monitors the air when you're down there. So if there's any problem, it'll start beeping. But the real reason you don't want to just lift up a manhole and go down the sewers is you've no idea what kind of volume of sewage is going to come pouring through if it starts raining, and it can go from a trickle to a torrent, and you can easily drown. People do drown in sewers. Sewer workers still drown in them.
The workers, by now, I would think, would know the danger signs.
Well, it's just so vulnerable to the weather. Of course, they do know their sewers, and they can regulate the flow, but it's still vulnerable.
Can you get sick if you spend a lot of time in a sewer?
Well, there's an argument that actually sewer workers are pretty healthy. Certainly all the ones I met look quite healthy. But you can get sick. Of course you can get sick. You can get something called sewer workers' disease, which...
They call it sewer workers' disease?
Yes, that's the nickname anyway. But that's not good. That affects your liver and your respiratory functions. So you don't really want to spend too much time down a sewer without people who know what they're doing.
What about the smell?
There's actually not that much smell. I know the first sewer I went down was the Fleet Sewer in London. And I remember specifically it was 10 p.m. at night. It was all a bit kind of dark and dangerous and sinister. And I was standing on the ladder going down the sewer, very, very nervous. And I was principally nervous about the smell. And I kept going down the ladder and thinking it's going to hit me. Any minute it's going to hit me. And I got to the bottom. And it was fine. It's just kind of musty and fusty, but certainly not what you'd expect.
My guest is Rose George. Her book, The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, published by Metropolitan Books. You said you have to get permission. What happens when you request permission to go into a sewer system? Did they just say, sure, Rose, we're thrilled to let you come into the London sewers or the New York sewers?
It was different in both. It was a bit easier in London, actually. I think they do have an open day in London, so maybe they're used to taking guests down the sewers. Apparently, Prince Charles has been down the sewers in London. So that was quite straightforward. But it was a bit harder getting down the New York sewers, I think, because they get so many requests from people that their default reaction is, no way.
Wait, they get a lot of requests? There
are
a lot of people
curious.
Who are curious?
Yeah, people are curious to go down the sewers.
Okay, don't spare me, but which sewer system is better right now, London or New York?
Better in terms of aesthetics?
Cleaner?
No sewer system's going to be clean.
Because
it's very
nature, transporting messy stuff.
I think they're both in a pretty parlous state, actually. I think they could both do with more money and more attention and a little more love and affection.
The people who clean the sewers in London are quite different from the ones in New York. I was surprised that they're pretty much all white, you told me, male.
Yes, it is. In London, it is still very much a white, working-class male environment, kind of like the London taxi cab.
Despite the fact that London is such a diverse city.
Yes, it's very strange. I don't know why there are...
Usually immigrants are given
exactly,
this message.
Yeah, but I think it's a kind of a bit of a closed shop because maybe it's such a niche field that they kind of... And there are so few of them. In London, there are only... When I went down, there were only 39 full-time flushers, as they're known. There are far more in New York. There are hundreds here, so maybe there's just more job opportunities.
Were there... There were no women in London. Were there any women working in New York?
Not that I met, no. My crew was entirely male.
In a Beijing bookstore, you found several shelves of books that were under the heading Toilet Culture. What does toilet culture mean?
I did. That made me very happy. I bought most of them and then had them translated.
Is this unique to China?
Well, I've never seen a toilet culture bookshelf, certainly outside China. But they were mostly about history of toilets and folklore. And I mean, China has confronted this issue for a very long time. During the Cultural Revolution and during the communism period, they would regularly take night soil collectors. So these are the people who would empty chamber pots at night. They became National Party heroes, and they became famous nationwide because it was recognized that they were doing a very important job.
Weren't they also putting their health in jeopardy?
They were, but they did get this chance to stand up on stage and be given a medal, so they got some reward. But yes, their health did suffer.
Japan is a country that seems to have gone through the biggest tradition for, in the old days, pretty much all of the fertilizer was fecal waste, human fecal waste, wasn't it? That's the reason that they had the communal baths?
Mm-hmm. They did have, like China, had this very extensive night soil collection system. But again, that happened in London 300 years ago and in the States as well. But with population growth, the fields got further away, the city grew, and it just became uneconomical.
60 years ago, it was a nation that only used pit latrines. And when you asked what they were too polite to tell you.
They are very polite in Japan, which is why it's astonishing that Japan has had a toilet revolution in the last 60 years. And from being a nation that used squatting pit latrines and never talking about the toilet, they now have the most advanced toilets in the world, which have the nickname robo-toilets, but they can wash you, dry you, play you music, do pretty much anything except read to you, I think. So it's really quite astonishing.
A toilet does more than just simply handle the waste and then flush it down?
Yeah, it's a luxury. We would think of it as a luxury item, but in Japan it's absolutely standard. It's so standard to have a bidet function in your toilet with a remote control pad attached to the toilet. These are so standard that apparently Japanese school children refuse to use any other kind of toilet anymore. They're that common.
But this is at a time when bidets are being phased out in France.
Exactly. Before, in France, about, I think, 90% of French homes had a bidet, and now it's 10 to 20%, which to me is a little odd because I actually believe in water as a cleansing method more than paper. So it's strange that France is rejecting the bidet, whereas Japan is promoting it like there's no tomorrow.
How did they even come up with this complicated toilet approach?
It was a gradual process. There's one of the preeminent toilet companies in Japan is called Toto, and they imported a bidet from the States, in fact. So Japan owes its toilet revolution to the States.
Haven't they just tried to sell the Toto in the United States?
They have been trying, and they are making some progress, but Americans are not yet convinced that they need to have a bidet in their toilet, which is a shame, because once you try a Toto or any of the other companies' bidet toilets, you never go back.
Mm-hmm. But they don't seem to have caught on here. Are they very expensive?
They are expensive. They're much more expensive than the kind of standard product you can get in a kind of plumber's depot or something. So they are a bit more expensive, but they are, I think, kind of an unmissable toilet experience. Once you try them, you probably might invest in them.
Do they require a lot of water?
No, you can get low-flow toilets as well. What they do require is electricity, so their energy consumption is a little bit questionable, but it's not very much. But no, you do have low-flow models as well that use not much water for the flush, so they can be competitive.
How much does the level of toilet tell us about a country in general? Should I assume that pretty much all the third world countries don't have many functioning toilets except in the fancy hotels?
You can assume that certainly in places like India and China you won't.
Though India and China are booming economies right
even
now?
Even though they're booming economies, they have yet to sort out their sanitation situation. That is changing. There are some very interesting movements to change this. But yes, in India, thanks to men like Dr. Patak, who I mentioned earlier, he has also installed public toilets in a lot of airports. But I think actually the barometer of a country's civilization is whether it provides public bathrooms. Certainly in London, we've closed down half our public bathrooms in the last 10 years, and I don't think the situation in New York is much better. So,
in fact, in London, many of the underground stations, the subway stations, had public bathrooms with attendants, and that was a nice job for somebody. I would have thought that they would have been relatively inexpensive to maintain because you had to pay to get into them.
Well, the reason that a lot of public bathrooms have closed in the UK is because the thinking is that an attendant actually is expensive, that you have to pay a salary. But I think in the long term, because when you have an attendant in a public bathroom, you're not going to have as much vandalism, you're not going to have drug use, and you're just going to it's an investment in the long term. But sadly, many local authorities don't see it that way.
And in New York, where there used to be a lot of public toilets in the subway, but there were no attendants, the concern was that stuff was going on in there that we didn't want to know about, drug use and other things.
Right. And so the instinctive reaction is to close them down, which is a shame for all New Yorkers. Because most people spend so much, probably, of their brain time strategically thinking about where to find a bathroom.
And then you go into a restaurant and it says, restrooms for customers only.
Exactly. So you're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. And I don't know how New Yorkers manage. They must be extremely forward-thinking. But in the UK, there's a new scheme where some restaurants...
We have a lot of self-control here in New York.
Well, humans have a lot of self-control. That's how the system continues to function, and that's why there's no mass protest. But I'd like to see, you know, a street demonstration about public bathrooms.
So Japan is the future of toilets, at least in the Western world.
It's not necessarily the future. I think the future will be looking at how much water we're using, how much energy we're using, and simply asking the question whether this solution could do with some evolution. It's not necessarily putting in a robo-toilet.
Are there people out there who have new approaches to sewage treatment?
Yes, there are. There's a movement called ecological sanitation, which is generally involves some kind of composting. You can have a dry toilet. It doesn't involve sewage, because sewage is what happens when you add human waste to water. But this is a new and growing movement. It's very popular in many European countries like Scandinavia and Germany. And what it tries to do is to alleviate the pressure at the source. So rather than loading your sewage system down with all this volume of stuff that has to be cleaned expensively, you try and deal with the problem at source.
Well, you said that New York's system, sewage system, is rather fragile. Is it just a matter of us patching it up as we go along, or would we need to rethink the whole system?
Ideally, if I were feeling a bit revolutionary, I would say that we should rethink the whole system. But in practical terms, that's not going to happen. The infrastructure has been here too long. It works. There's no denying that it works. And as a system, the flush toilet and the sewer has been an incredible medical advancement at separating humans from a potentially toxic material. There's no denying that. So I don't think it's going to change, but I do think what needs to happen is for us to question whether we can make it better. It is generally, I think, going to be tinkered with. New things are going to be built that are going to be expensive. We're going to keep throwing money at it without questioning the concept and the design of it, and I think that's a shame.
Rose George's book is The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.